Hello, everyone. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you might be in the world. Welcome to this event jointly sponsored by the School of Public Policy at the LSE and Chatham House. Today, we come together to discuss a very important and very difficult issue. As I'm sure everybody on this call knows, on the 7th of November, Nicaragua held elections, or elections really in name only. They were neither free nor fair. And this is really not a matter for controversy anymore. The world's democracies have been unanimous in calling out precisely that lack of freedom and fairness in this process. US President Biden called the election a pantomime. That's exactly the word we borrowed for the title of this event. The elections were called and denounced as illegitimate by Spain and the EU, not credible according to the Organization of American States, and the list goes on and on. Clearly, elections that take place in a context in which opposition parties have been banned, political leaders have been imprisoned, there are severe limits to press freedom. Those are not the conditions under which freedom and democracy flourish in any country, least of all Nicaragua. So Chatham House and the LSE have come together to have a discussion not on what went on before, although of course we need to set the context, but on what should come next. Clearly, there are questions as to how the world's democracies should respond, how the friends of Nicaragua in any country, including, of course, the UK, where both LSE and Chatham House are based, what we can be doing and we should be doing, and what is effective helping the country return to a fully functioning democracy. It has veered pretty far away from that course. And of course, the people paying the price for that are the citizens and residents of Nicaragua, whose freedom is being curtailed. For that discussion, we are lucky to be hosting some very, very distinguished panelists, friends of the LSE and friends of Nicaragua. And I'm going to introduce them. Then I will very briefly share with you what one might call the rules of engagement. And then we will be off. Our panelists, and I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they will take the floor, are first of all Bianca Jagger, who is the founder, the president, and the chief executive of the Bianca Jagger Human Rights Foundation, which she established back in 2005. Born in Managua, Bianca left her native country to study political science in Paris. And since then, she's become a world-known and influential advocate for human rights. She is a goodwill ambassador for the Council of Europe. She is a member of the Leadership Council of Amnesty International. She is a Bond Challenge ambassador. And of course, she's a recipient of many awards for human rights, humanitarian, and environmental work. Next will come Carlos Chamorro, who is one of the most respected journalists, not only in Nicaragua, but also in Central America. He is the founder and the director of the digital medium Confidencial. And again, he has received a number of awards. Let me highlight the Ortega y Gasset Award from El País in Spain, which he just received in 2021 for his career defending freedom of expression and freedom of the press. Back in 2010, he received another influential and prestigious award, the Maria Moores Cabot Prize, given by the Columbia University School of Journalism. Today, for the second time in his life, Carlos is living in exile in Costa Rica, following persecution in his home country of Nicaragua. His two siblings, Cristiana, a presidential candidate, and Pedro Joaquin, another important opposition figure, are both political prisoners today in Managua. Next in our lineup will come James Doris, who's the head of the Latin America Department and the Deputy Director of the Americas at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the Government of the United Kingdom. A British career diplomat, James has previously served as the British High Commissioner to Sri Lanka and the Maldives and as ambassador to Peru. James has a degree in law from the University of Cambridge and is also a qualified solicitor. And then we will be honored to be hearing from Xavier Martí, who's the General Director for Iberoamerica and the Caribe at the Foreign Ministry of Spain. He also has been the Deputy Director for Foreign Affairs and has directed the cabinets of the Undersecretary and the Secretary of State for International Cooperation, again, in the Foreign Ministry of Spain. He has a degree in political science and public administration from Universidad Autónoma de Barcelona and is also a career diplomat. So here are the rules of engagement. We're going to ask each one of our speakers to take the floor for 7 or 8 minutes to give us their points of view, both on what is going on in Nicaragua and what should come next from Western democracies, from the European Union, from the United Kingdom, from the other democracies in the world. And then we will have a lively and I hope fruitful debate. Last but certainly not least, we're going to hear from Chris Sabatini, who is not only a dear friend of the LSE, of Nicaragua, and of many of us. Chris runs the Latin American program at Chatham House. And we have given Chris the difficult task of maybe drawing some conclusions from what I'm sure will be a very, very good discussion. There are many, many subjects and questions that we could be focusing on. One of them may be whether, you know, we're not coming late to this party in the sense that these events were predictable. The decline in the quality of democratic engagement and observance of democratic rules in Nicaragua has been happening for quite a while now. So one question might be, given that we're coming late to the point where democracies need to take action, what needs to be done? A perennial question in discussions such as this one is how effective sanctions are of one kind or another. It is hard not to have sanctions on the, you know, on the table, and it is natural that we should be discussing them, but their track record, one might say, in dealing with autocrats is mixed. So maybe exactly what to do, what kind of sanctions is also a natural question in this kind of discussion. But I certainly do not want to prejudge what the issues are and what the questions are. So without further ado, let me just hand it over to Bianca. Bianca, the floor is yours. And again, thank you very much for joining us.
Good evening. And thank you to all the people that have joined us. I would first like to express my gratitude to Andrea Velasco, Dean of the School of Public Policy at the London School of Economics and Political Science, because it was to him that I came to ask him to hold this event. And he kindly said yes right away and has done everything to support this event. I would also like to thank Christopher Sabatini, Senior Research Fellow for Latin America, US and the American program at Chatham House, and for both willingness to host this important event. I will also like to thank Kathy Aylesbury, Master of Public Policy at the LSE, for her invaluable contribution to this event. Thank you, Katie. I will be speaking in my capacity as founder and president of the Bianca Jagger Human Rights Foundation. I think that what I would like to see from what we're doing here is what are the lessons learned that did the international community responded as decisively and as fast as they should have done to prevent what is happening today in Nicaragua. Today in the country, we have a state of terror. Carlos Fernando calls it a police state. Daniel Ortega represses the people with his policy, his army, paramilitary forces, better known as mobs or death squads, party structures, neighborhood committees that force people to spy on each other, and the corrupt and subservient judicial system. These are the same structures that were employed to repress the nonviolent uprising and to murder protesters in 2018 with absolute impunity. Grave and systematic human rights violations have been extensively documented by reputable international organizations such as the UN Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, among others, and many human rights organizations inside Nicaragua. The Interdisciplinary Group of Independent Experts, GIEI, established by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, have concluded that crimes against humanity have been perpetrated by the Ortega regime. The IACHR reported that up to the 8th of August 2019, 328 people have been murdered. But it is important to point out that in September 2018, the Ortega regime expelled the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the GIEI, and the United Nations Officer of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. The regime has not allowed further visit from Amnesty, from Human Rights Watch, and from any other human rights organization. And this is one of the things that I hope the international community will put pressure so that we could demand that they come into the country. Among the most egregious human rights violations by the Ortega Murillo regime, when the instruction given by the Minister of Health in April 2018 to deny medical attention to wounded protesters after leaving them to die at the doorstep of the hospital. Today, human rights violations affect practically all sectors of Nicaraguan society. As of now, there are over 160 non-political prisoners in Nicaragua. Political leaders have been jailed, including seven presidential candidates, de facto eliminating any meaningful opposition leadership. These leaders represent politicians, members of civil society, women, students, campesinos, journalists, and members of the private sector. People from all walks of life in Nicaragua, both from the right and from the left, including prominent former iconic Sandinista leaders that participated in the struggle against Somoza and that also took part in the operation to free Ortega from Somoza prison, are in jail. The latest round of abduction and detention began on the 28th of May. And Daniel Ortega is denied access to lawyers, medical and humanitarian assistance, and family members to all those he's holding hostage. He has not even permitted that the papal nuncio deliver Bibles. And why is that important, you will say? Well, because of some of the political prisoners have asked, some of them are in isolation, and they have asked to have a Bible. We all know how the Ortega regime, the Ortega Murillo regime, has cruel policies against all international conventions and norms and basic humanity. Other human rights violations that have not been adequately documented are the arbitrary detention and summary executions of poor farmers, campesinos, indigenous people, and the Afro-descendants that are victims of the repression from the Ortega's army in remote and rural areas. Little is known about what takes place in this isolated region. Journalists have been victims of a relentless persecution by the Ortega regime, and freedom of the press is under assault, and several well-known journalists among the illegal detained. I will leave it to Carlos Fernando to really relate to us what he has experienced. Medical doctors, medical staff have been persecuted, jailed, and exiled. Nearly 500 medical staff have been fired from public institutions, mainly related to the April 2018 uprising for upholding the Hippocratic Oath and tending to the wounded, but also because of disagreement of the reckless handling of the COVID-19 pandemic by the regime. Other has been stopped at airports and border crossing. Their passport have been confiscated, becoming de facto prisoners within Nicaragua. Other has been forced into exile and are hiding within the country or are under constant surveillance and harassment. I can't tell you how many calls I received from students, from human rights defenders, from journalists who are in Nicaragua and who are trying to escape and who are fearing that they will be the next one to be put in jail. I would like to appeal to the international community to help us, Nicaraguan, to hold free, fair, and democratic elections. And in order to achieve this, there are five conditions that need to be met because we need to begin to think about the future and how it is that we will one day have a democracy in Nicaragua. A, the release of all presidential candidates, political, civil society, students, poor farmers, campesinos, and private sector leaders, and the journalists currently in prison under bogus and fraudulent charges, such as high treason and money laundering. An immediate withdrawal of all spurious inhibitions that will prevent the participation of the above mentioned presidential candidate and candidates for other popularly elected position, the immediate restitution of civil and political liberties of the Nicaraguan citizen, including free mobilization, freedom of assembly, and the free exercise without harassment or persecution of the activities of members of the press. The immediate cessation of all acts of repression and intimidation that the regime is carrying out with total impunity with the help of its police, army, paramilitary force, and mob, as I mentioned before. I think that we need to begin to think about when will Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo and his crony be able to face the international, international justice. Is there any way that he can be accountable? The international community should not and cannot recognize the November 7th fraudulent electoral process and its result, and should declare the Daniel Ortega regime as illegitimate. Over 50 countries have so far criticized the November 7th farce, many of them declaring it them illegitimate, hence making also the result illegitimate. The OAS General Assembly agreed last week to declare that in the evident circumstances, the election on November 7 in Nicaragua were not free, fair, or transparent and had no democratic legitimacy. A majority of countries, 25, in fact, voted in favor of that resolution, and only one regime representative, Nicaragua, voted against and seven abstained. The Ortega regime did everything to undermine the November 21 electoral process, in addition to incarcerating presidential candidates and forcing others into exile. The regime approved a series of repressive laws that further reduced the already limited democratic space in the country. The world cannot recognize another fraudulent election. The increased repression during the last 6 months made the chance for free, fair, and democratic election vanish. What is happening in Nicaragua is that you have a serious exodus of the people of Nicaragua. Some 60,000 Nicaraguans are expected to be apprehended in the US southern border by the end of this year. The number of Nicaraguans apprehended have already surpassed those of Salvadoran migrants. In addition, the number of migrants that are leaving and that are arriving in Costa Rica is probably in more than 130,000. Costa Rica is a very small country that is being destabilized by their generosity, because they are receiving every day about 1,000 requests for people from Nicaragua to be granted asylum. The world needs to pay more attention to Nicaragua. The international system designed to defend human rights is not working for the people of Nicaragua. Solidarity, public resolutions, and condemnation are important, are not welcome, but are not sufficient. They will only be effective if the pressure is proportional to the level of repression of the regime. Of course, you will say to me that we had Renacer Act that was approved in both houses in the US Congress bipartisan. That is a light at the end of the tunnel for the people in Nicaragua. The Renacer, which in Spanish means rebirth, has sent a signal of hope to Nicaraguans and also an unequivocal signal to Ortega, the international community, the US, EU, the UK, Switzerland. The OAS needs to work in close collaboration to stop the dynamic designs of Ortega and Murillo to consolidate a North Korea-like dynasty dictatorship in the middle of the America. I received today, and I cannot read it to you, that the United States, the US Department of Treasury Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC, designated the Public Ministry of Nicaragua, Ministerio Público, as well as 9 officials of the government of Nicaragua in response to the sham national election orchestrated by President Daniel Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo. This action targets those who are representing Nicaragua for exercising their human rights and fundamental freedom. That is welcome. It is very important to me to have you both, Mr. Martí and Mr. Doris, participating at this event. And I hope that, I know that Spain has played a key role in supporting Nicaragua and that your president has been clear in his condemnation of what Daniel Ortega has done. And I know even that he has called the ambassador back to Spain. And I welcome the role that the UK is playing. And I appeal to the UK government to do more and to work in combination with the others. The one thing that I like to say before I go is that the overseas investments of the Ortega family and collaborators, including those of the Nicaraguan military, need to be frozen. Also, any remaining US ties with the Nicaraguan military need to be severed. Nicaragua is the only one of 20 countries in the world that has a free trade agreement with the US, which according to Freedom House is not free. This is unsubstantially a country without rule of law cannot responsibly comply with the obligation of labor, competition, environmental of any kinds of rule, with a notoriously corrupt and partisan judiciary, with a dictator and a mafia-like government. Ortega will self-exclude the country from this important treaty, further affecting hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm here to appeal to the European Union as well, to consider the trade agreements with Nicaragua. I know that you have been thinking about it and that has been hesitant, but the time has come for us to do everything in our power, everything for the international community to weaken the government of Ortega and Murillo. And it is my hope that the international community will be able to help us. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Thank you, Bianca, for those unpleasant but very, very important truths. I'm going to hand it over to Carlos Fernando now. Allow me to remind speakers that we do have a limited number of minutes for the whole event. So if you could hold your remarks to about 6 or 7 minutes so that we can go around and then maybe have some interaction and questions, that would be absolutely, absolutely brilliant. Thank you, Bianca, again. Carlos Fernando, over to you.
Thank you very much to Professor Andre Velasco, to LSE, and to Chatham House for this opportunity. My newsroom, confidential and independent media outlet that I have directed during 25 years, have been assaulted and occupied twice by the police with no legal orders. First in December 2018 during an escalation of repression, and the second time in May 20 this year during the beginning of the new wave of repression that ended up with the electoral crackdown with the detention of 40 citizens, including 7 aspiring presidential candidates of the opposition and dozens of political leaders, among them several civic leaders, peasants, university students, journalists, businessmen, and human rights defenders. So I am in exile in Costa Rica to protect my freedom and to keep doing journalism. After my house was raided by the police, I face an arrest order and an accusation for so-called money laundering for the crime of doing investigative journalism, denouncing corruption and human rights violations in a political trial, which are facing my sister, Cristiana, an aspiring presidential candidate who is under house arrest, and my brother, Pedro Joaquin, who is in prison in El Chipote in isolation with more than 35 other prisoners. So I'm reporting in Nicaragua from Costa Rica, like more than 20 journalists in exile, overcoming censorship through internet and social media, but I no longer have any public or independent sources that I can quote, because there has been a suppression of freedom of expression, and all sources, either they are lawyers, politicians, analysts, professors, common citizens, businessmen, or religious leaders, cannot be quoted because of fear of retaliation and state reprisals. In Nicaragua, we have lived under this police state since September 2018, after the civic protests demanding free elections were massacred by the police and the paramilitary forces led by President Ortega with the complicity of the army. The massacres, as Bianca just said, generated more than 300 assassinations that are all in impunity. And the police state is a de facto situation where no state of emergency has been established by freedom of reunion, freedom of mobilization, and freedom of the press, and freedom of expression have been suppressed. Although we were under this police state and President Ortega had full control of all branches of the state, including the electoral system, the pro-democracy movement in Nicaragua accepted to participate in the November 7 election and decided to select a single candidate. But Ortega was not willing to risk power at all and put all of them in prison, eliminating electoral competition. This is how he was reelected or self-elected in November 7, in a process that both Nicaraguans, with a level of abstention higher than 80%, and more than 50 countries of the international community, including the OAS, the European Union, and UK, deny any kind of political legitimacy. Regarding the question of this panel about what Western democracy should do, I am not a policymaker. I am a journalist who is used to ask these tough questions to my sources, so I don't have the answers. But as a Nicaraguan citizen, I will make three comments for the discussion. First, the international isolation and individual sanctions against the dictatorship high officers, like the ones that were announced today by the US Treasury and by the UK, are necessary but not sufficient for the restoration of democracy. A dictatorship like the Ortega Murillo regime can survive sanctions and stay in power longer, but it cannot last 1 month without the police state. In the moment Nicaraguans can recover their rights of reunion and mobilization, the power of the regime is over, because there is a large political majority in Nicaragua that want a change through free elections. Second, there is a need for international pressure, not only to weaken the Ortega power, but also to strengthen people power through, number one, the liberation of more than 160 political prisoners, and two, the suspension of the police state. How to establish a direct conditionality between the two, between the external pressure and the domestic situation in Nicaragua, is a key question. And that includes also the situation of the press, which is under persecution. And finally, I believe the international community faces a credibility crisis and is in debt with Nicaraguan society regarding the issue of the police state. In March 29, 2019, during the second national dialogue, the Nicaraguan foreign minister, Denis Moncada, signed an agreement with the Civic Alliance representing the opposition, making a commitment to restore all constitutional rights and to suspend the police state. But Ortega never complied. Today, four of the six members of the opposition that signed that agreement, Juan Sebastián Chamorro, José Palé, José Adán Aguirre, and Max Jerez, are in prison. And the international community that acted as the witness of this agreement, represented by the OAS and the Vatican, did nothing to oblige Ortega to comply. In conclusion, only extreme National and international pressure can force Ortega back to the negotiation table, probably in a middle round strategy that should also involve the reconstruction of Nicaraguan civil society. But there is also a need for effective international guarantors for any plan of transition to democracy in Nicaragua. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos Fernando, for that personal and direct testimony of the kinds of abuses that Nicaraguan citizens and particularly members of the press are being subjected to on a regular basis. Let us move on now to our two friends from the UK and the Spanish government, two countries that have been quite active in trying to shape the international response to the quickly deteriorating situation in Nicaragua. And we will hear from James first and from Xavier next. James, thanks again for joining us. Floor is yours.
Thanks, Andres, and it's a real pleasure to be with Bianca and Carlos and my Spanish colleagues today. If I start, I'll say something about the UK position on elections this month. Rigged elections on Sunday, the 7th of November, Sunday before last, were the culmination of years of democratic backsliding, human rights violations, and the erosion of the rule of law at the hands of the regime. And President Ortega and his wife, Vice President Rosario Murillo, remain in power only after having all credible opposition candidates arrested and disqualified from standing for election. Their abuses in recent months, including the detention of opposition candidates, the intimidation and arrest of opposition party supporters, and the prevention by the authorities of public campaigns and the regime's dominance and manipulation of both conventional and social media, have prevented the Nicaraguan people from making the democratic choice they have every right to make. And the UK's position is clear, that the elections were neither free nor fair, and that quite simply, the result is not and cannot reasonably be claimed to be a democratic expression of the will of the Nicaraguan people. And we were pleased to see countries from around the Americas uniting behind the recent OAS resolution last week that elections were not free, fair, or transparent and lacked democratic legitimacy. Moving on to the political situation more generally in Nicaragua, I think it's fair to say that democracy in Nicaragua is in dire trouble. That this is so is no accident. Rather, it's the result of a systematic and deliberate dismantling and collusion in the dismantling not only of democracy, but also of a set of linked, universally recognized and accepted rights. This process of converting, or one could say reconverting, Nicaragua into an autocracy has been going on for many years. There's the pattern of increasing interference in presidential and other elections of well over a decade, the passing of anti-democratic and increasingly repressive legislation, the effect of which is cumulative, including this year and last, the accumulation of conventional and social media power in the hands of regime family members and people close to them, and increasingly the oppression of the independent media. There are serious human rights violations committed over more than a decade. Bianca reminded us the most awful of these were committed in 2018. And there is the determined and purposeful concentration of power in every aspect of government in the hands of Daniel Ortega and those closest to him. We're talking about not only government, the executive power, but the National Assembly, the Supreme Court, the judiciary, the police, the armed forces, the prosecutor's office. In short, President Ortega and Vice President Murillo have sadly led Nicaragua down this tragic path to authoritarianism. The dictatorial Somoza regime that the Sandinistas took great risk to overthrow was in power for 43 years, from 1936 to 1979. And it's striking that this year, it's 42 years since 1979, when Daniel Ortega first served as leader of Nicaragua. And I think it's fair to say that the sad fact is, though they would object to the comparison, that the Ortega regime increasingly resembles the Somoza regime that was overthrown more than 40 years ago. Moving on, the UK will always be a fierce champion for freedom and democracy around the world. Earlier today, some of the people on the call will no doubt have seen the UK impose new sanctions against 8 senior Nicaraguan politicians and officials for their parts in undermining Nicaragua's democratic principles and institutions, the commission of serious human rights violations, and the repression of civil society. The 8 newly listed individuals include the Vice President, Rosario Murillo, the Attorney General, and the President of the Supreme Court, and picking up on one of the points earlier, 2 senior officers in the Nicaraguan National Police. And sanctions, yes, they're not a perfect solution, of course, but they are there as a strong signal from the UK and from other countries. People on the call will also have seen, I'm sure, that the US, and we heard the US has also introduced new sanctions today, that those responsible for attacks on democracy, on human rights and fundamental freedoms are going to face a real cost for their actions and the choices they have made. The step that we took today was coordinated with the US, our ambition, our hope is that the sanctions will help to put pressure on the regime to change its behaviour and end the repression of its citizens. Looking forwards, we've stated clearly what we are looking to the Nicaraguan authorities to do immediately. We have called for the immediate and unconditional release of all opposition leaders and other political prisoners in Nicaragua, and for the full restoration of their civil and political rights. We've said that repression of independent media must stop. Freedom of expression is, everybody on this call, I hope, will agree, a fundamental human right. Human rights observers must be allowed into Nicaragua and must be allowed to work unimpeded. And we will look to the regime to re-establish substantive, meaningful national dialogue with opposition parties and pro-democracy groups, and to take all the steps necessary once again to make Nicaragua the properly functioning democracy the Nicaraguan people want their country to be. Close diplomatic coordination with democracies in both the West and Latin America will be key. And as I've said, the UK will be working closely with partners in the region and beyond. We'll support leadership in Latin America. We welcome the strong messages of concern from so many countries in the region at the deterioration of political and human rights in Nicaragua. As an observer in the OAS and in other multilateral fora, we'll continue to speak out in support of democracy and draw attention to what is happening in Nicaragua. The UK is also committed to the promotion of media freedom and the protection of journalists. People in Nicaragua must be allowed to discuss and debate issues freely and to challenge their government. For that, strong and robust media are vital. In 2020, we added Nicaragua to the Foreign Office's, the FCDO's list of human rights priority countries, and we will continue to report and record the violations of the Nicaraguan authorities in the department's annual human rights report. And through all of this, we will also look to continue to find opportunities to support the people of Nicaragua where they're in need, as we did in the aftermath of Hurricanes Eta and Iota last year. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, James. It is, I think, a fitting and appropriate summary of the situation in Nicaragua that both the Attorney General and the President of the Supreme Court would merit, in the eyes of the UK, sanctions for being complicit in human rights violations. I think that fact alone, in some sense, says it all. And of course, the message it sends is worrying in the extreme. Xavier, tell us a bit about Spain and the European Union and their position and plans regarding this very difficult situation. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Andrés Velasco. And first of all, let me thank you, the London School of Economics and the Chatham House, for the invitation to take part in this event to discuss the situation in Nicaragua with Bianca Jagger, Carlos Fernando Chamorro, James Doris, and Christopher Sabatini. It's an honor to be here with you today. As you know, Spain has tried to help since the outbreak of the crisis in Nicaragua to find a solution bilaterally and working together with our partners of the European Union and with other members of the international community. Unfortunately, it has been impossible to correct the authoritarian drift of Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo. The Spanish government has issued around 20 public statements to express its position since the crisis broke out in April 2018. We have denounced the situation on many occasions. We have called and worked actively for a unified European Union response. And we have also worked with other partners, such as the members of the SICA. In fact, on the occasion of the Spain SICA summit last June in Costa Rica, we succeeded to issue a joint statement with Costa Rica, Belize, Guatemala, Panama, and Dominican Republic regarding the situation in Nicaragua. Following the last repressive wave, which began last June, we expressed our concerns regarding the repressive and authoritarian regime established by the government of Nicaragua with the adoption of a regressive legal framework and the collusion of the legislative and judicial powers, both controlled by Ortega. We also condemned the systematic persecution of political, social, and economic actors, the detention of the main leaders and candidates of the opposition, the harassment and repression of independent media, and the outlawing of opposition political parties. And we recalled as well our ambassador on the 18th of August in protest to the situation and with the objective to reassess the relation with the Nicaraguan authorities. Our most recent statement issued on the 8th of November, the day after the election, was not by chance the first public reaction from an European government. And Spain also promoted and subscribed the European Union statement issued by the High Representative and Vice President Josep Borrell in the name of all member states also on the 8th of November. Both statements contain very clearly the main elements of our position regarding the Nicaraguan crisis. The government of Spain rejects the results of the elections due to the unacceptable and arbitrary conditions in which they were held. We consider and so expressed that the elections lacked the minimum democratic guarantees required by international standards. Daniel Ortega eliminated all credible electoral competition and deprived the people of Nicaragua of a free and full exercise of their voting rights, and also deprived them of their freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. We denounced the absence of the opposition in the process, as its leaders were and they are still in prison or exiled. And we also denounced the absence of international observers and independent national and international press. In this sense, we condemned the closure of critical media and the expulsion of Nicaraguan journalists, as well as the denial of entry to the country to international correspondents, including several Spanish journalists. In these circumstances, our assessment is that the elections were a sham, a mockery, and they do not reflect the genuine will of the Nicaraguan people. Therefore, we cannot give credibility and legitimacy to its results. In this context, our demands to the Nicaraguan authorities are also very clear. First of all, and in line with what Bianca said before, the Spanish government demands free, fair, transparent, and concurrent elections that guarantee the participation of all Nicaraguans. Only a credible, inclusive, and transparent electoral process in accordance with international democratic standards can offer a way out to the social, political, and economic crisis in Nicaragua. In this context, it is essential also to implement the recommendations of the different international institutions regarding the reform of the electoral legal system. Secondly, we reiterate our condemn of the detention of the main leaders and candidates of the opposition who are in prison, and consequently, we demand the Nicaraguan authorities that the immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners and protesters arbitrarily imprisoned and the annulment of legal proceedings against them. Thirdly, the government of Spain also demands the Nicaraguan authorities to restitute and guarantee the fundamental rights of the Nicaraguan citizens, including the restitution of the legal personality of opposition political parties and civil society organizations. And we also demanded the Nicaraguan authorities to comply with their international commitments in the field of human rights and with their own constitution. That's important, their own constitution. They must also allow the return to the country of the international human rights mechanisms, such as the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And finally, our last demand is that the Nicaraguan authorities put an end to the repression and harassment of independent media and journalists. From our perspective, it is very relevant that there are more than 40 reactions from the international community, states, and international organizations rejecting the legitimacy of the results or condemning that the elections took place in non-democratic conditions. The resolution of the General Assembly of the Organization of American States on the 12th of November also proves one more time to what extent the Nicaraguan regime is isolated. And finally, let me mention also very briefly another dimension, which is also very important for us, our firm commitment to continue supporting the economic and social development of the most vulnerable sectors of Nicaraguan society. In the Spanish case, the donation of more than 1.7 million vaccines against COVID-19 through the COVAX mechanism is a clear proof of this commitment. And of course, our commitment with a solution to the current crisis is also clear. We will, of course, continue to work with our partners in the European Union. One of the areas in which we are already working is the possible adoption of new restrictive measures. And we will also continue our work with other international allies with the objective that Nicaraguans can regain their rights and freedoms and can exercise them in a democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Xavier. Thank you very much. It is also good to hear how clear the message from the government of Spain and the EU are in this juncture. Chris, would you like to come in now and maybe give us a little summary and show us the way forward? I may use my chair's privilege afterwards to ask a question or two of our panelists, and then we will invite the audience, of course, to submit questions. And before I hand it over to Chris, if you are listening in, the Q&A function is open. There are a number of questions there already, and I do not promise I will get to all of them because time is limited, but please feel free to contribute, and we will do our best to allow people to get their questions to the panelists. But before that, Chris Abatini from Chatham House, for a few words of wisdom, or actually many words of wisdom, perhaps.
Or maybe less wisdom, more words. We'll see. well, first of all, brilliant presentations by everyone. And there's so many strands to pick up. I obviously can't do them all justice. I want to pick up on two and then relate them to Javier's and James's comments. One is what Bianca said, which is that the international human rights system failed. And that's clear. The erosion, steady erosion of democracy and checks and balances and steady repression of the state, consolidation of personal power, pretty much went unmentioned, let alone unchecked internationally, basically from 2007 on. So the question is could we have done more before? Maybe that wouldn't have made a difference. Clearly, Daniel Ortega learned his lesson in 1990 that he's never going to leave power in an honest election ever again. The question then is what can be done? And that turns to the point that Carlos said is, as a Nicaraguan citizen, but I admire him being humble and speaking as a citizen, but also he's a journalist with a great wealth of experience and knowledge of these situation, his citizens, and some of the players even around in the opposition. And that's the issue of negotiations. And clearly Carlos's point is absolutely right that the Vatican and the OAS did not sort of live up to their moral obligations to protect the people they, I wouldn't say forced, but encouraged to sign an agreement. Four of them are now in prison. The question is what can be done now? And what's clear is the government of Ortega is not going to go to a table in good faith. It never was, perhaps. But that goes to the point then what James and Javier were saying, which is denunciations are good, and certainly we appreciate the sanctions that have been placed on them. Question is, it's twofold. The first, what incentives can be placed in those sanctions that actually hit the players who are likely to flip, to change their minds? Because ultimately, this is not even your standard garden variety dictatorship. This is a corrupt police state, as Carlos said many times. The question is it's the security sector. Ortega, Murillo are not going to change their positions. They're not going to step down willingly. They know full well, as Bianca said, they'll face the Court of Justice internationally once they do. So the question then becomes, how do you force a change within the security sector? And that's the key. And part of this is obviously restricting their financial mobility, restricting their financial assets and their diplomatic mobility, as well as their respectability. But who can you reach out to within that? And you know, sanctions, blanket sanctions aren't going to be sufficient, but the question then is how can you hit those where they must be hit? The second is, and I appreciate all the efforts and discussions of greater coordination with the EU and with Latin American leaders. Now, I'm going to think back to the time, which is probably not a favorable one for Daniel Ortega, when he had elections in 1990 and lost. And the Contador piece, Contador process, Esquipulas process that actually led to those elections. What can we extract from those in terms of taking credible Latin American leaders that working with European governments, with the US, can try to force some sort of negotiations that have teeth? And so I guess I'd put this question out there, if I can abuse my role as the making the concluding remarks, is, you know, what are some thoughts here that what can be done in terms of coordination to make negotiations that matter and to impose sanctions that are going to perhaps change the calculations of those in the security sector, because clearly placing sanctions on Ortega and Murillo, on them personally, and even hurting their citizens don't matter. So let me ask actually in reverse order, if I can. Javier, a little bit, just your thoughts on what can be done in terms of, is there a possibility, a scope for more coordinated action on the European Union that presents that form of conditionality that Carlos talked about? Because I think what failed here isn't so much the international system, the negotiations, it was the cohesiveness and the faith in how they should be conducted and the target. Do you have any thoughts you're willing to share in terms of how this could move forward in terms of conditionality and negotiations, Javier?
Thank you for the question, which is not easy, which is not an easy one. But the thing is that the restrictive measures, the sanctions, are one of the measures that can be adopted. But that's not all what we can do, and we shouldn't focus only with the sanctions. The sanctions are an element, a basic element, and at the same time we have to keep the pressure. Some of the panelists already talk about keeping the pressure with public statements and keeping the pressure with our diplomatic actions. And at the same time, there are also other measures that have to be adopted in terms of, or that can be adopted in terms, for example, Bianca commented them before, the possibility of examining or checking the financing of the financing institutions via some of the development banks, for example. Also, the possibility of acting from the European Union perspective with the EU free data, with the EU association agreement with Central America. All those possibilities are already on the table, and we are examining all of them. We are, from our perspective, Nicaragua must be on the agenda, and that's why we are trying to keep this file on the agenda at the EU level, and all these measures have to be examine as a whole, and then we will have to be very cautious and identify exactly the targets of the any new restrictive measure that is adopted, and the idea is, of course, adopting measures that do not have a negative impact on the Nicaraguans. They already suffer a lot because of the situation, but targeting exactly the people and the institutions that can have a direct relation with the repressive apparatus, and that's the place where we are. We already have these sanctions today published by the United States, UK, in our case, we are still working on that. But yes, there is an option to get to what you were asking for.
James, the UK has a free trade agreement with Central America. Other thoughts of including that in this? As well as just another question, I hate to sort of pile more on, and I know Andres wants to ask questions for his own questions as well as questions from the audience. So maybe I'll end with this, James, is, you know, the other issue is the international community is going to be confronted with a president that it largely over 40 countries do not accept as being legitimate. Where do you go from here? What is the exit strategy? Is it sort of the convening of another election, say, like in 1994 in Dominican Republic with Balaguer? Is there, you know, is there some potential exit strategy that you can push for rather than sitting back and saying, okay, let's wait until another election 4 years, 5 years from now? James?
Thanks, Chris. And perhaps I could begin by adding something to Xavier's answer. I agree, it's not an easy question. The effectiveness of sanctions, in part, of course, depends where assets are. You can impose financial sanctions, but if the people being sanctioned don't have any assets in your country and don't plan to travel there or do any business with you, then you know, you can argue about what the value is. But there is, of course, an important symbolic value. And I think it's the point that you know, when the international community acts together, many of the people who sanctions are targeted at do have assets somewhere. It ties into the point, which is also being picked up in the chat, about the lack of consistency, or the fact that, you know, the international community is not speaking with one voice on this. And Nicaragua, of course, is by no means the exception. There are other countries in the region with whom countries on, you know, certainly European Union, UK, Canada, US have not dissimilar concerns, but again, where we find some important members of the international community taking positions quite different from ours. That's one group of countries. A second group is the group which is more comfortable sitting on the fence and not really saying quite what they think of the situation. And I think it's fair to say that we've seen that in a couple of the statements that have come out over the past 8 days or so since last Sunday's election results were announced. And I think for countries which are currently leaving their position a little more ambivalent than they might do, actually they would help by coming out more strongly, certainly within the Americas, and saying, we don't think that this is the way that any country in the OAS should be behaving, which also picks up on one of the points in the chat about the position being taken by some Caribbean states. It's generally the case, as we'll all have seen, that autocratic governments, not always, but tend to support other autocratic governments. One, because they don't want to open themselves up to charges of hypocrisy, odd though it may seem. Secondly, because it's always good to be able to count on somebody's support. And if I support you, hopefully you will support me. I think on the carrots and sticks question, it's, you know, it's a real challenge for the international community. How do you encourage a regime like the Ortega's to make progress back towards democracy again? We see the similar challenge in international community support for the principle that the regime and combined opposition are at the moment working their way through a set of talks hosted in Mexico. Around, you know, the way forward for Venezuela. And part of this is about sticks, and we've talked about sanctions as sticks, and part of it also needs to be about carrots. And I think it's, you know, one of the challenges for international community is again to reflect on where, you know, what is the way out in a sense that you offer. How do you encourage a regime like the Ortega's, not just president and vice president, but the many, many people who are working with them in taking Nicaragua down its current path, to see light at the end of a tunnel which would take them in a different direction. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. And sorry, Andres, I didn't mean to outsource my words of wisdom to Xavier. I'll leave it there and let you take the questions from everyone else, and then maybe Bianca and Carlos, your reflections at the end. Thank you.
No, that is absolutely brilliant. And those are, I think, very important and timely questions. I'm going to ask one general question to Bianca and or Carlos Fernando, and then we'll go to the Q&A with the audience. We have about half an hour to go. Several people, including both Xavier and James, maybe Chris too, mentioned the magical word, negotiations. And of course, you know, negotiations are typically the kind of word that you want to hear in these situations. You know, it means people talking to each other. At the same time, if one looks at the precedent in other countries of the region, I have Venezuela in mind, years of negotiations have failed miserably for the simple reason, if I may say so plainly, that in order to negotiate, you need two parties that sit at the table in good faith. And when one of the two parties is simply playing for time, then negotiations will lead absolutely nowhere. So Carlos or Bianca, is negotiations, or are negotiations, I should say, the sort of thing that we should look forward to? Or in the current circumstances, would they simply be a way of diverting attention from other more pressing issues because of lack of goodwill on the part of the regime?
Before
Bianca.
Okay. So before talking about negotiation, I would first say there is the need of a middle round strategy. At this moment, we're still enjoying maximum attention of the post-electoral farce. How long this is going to last? This is the first question. This is a very profound systemic crisis that required extreme national and international pressure in order to change the balance of power. I don't think this is the moment for negotiation. This is the moment for extreme pressure in a middle round process. And I insist, there is a need to establish a connection between international pressure and domestic lack of freedom. Somebody mentioned things about incentives, and people said, what kind of incentive would Ortega would have in order to participate? I don't think about Ortega and Murillo. I think about the elite behind them. I think about the army. I think about the high rank officers of the government and the party. Those are the ones who really should see that there is no future with Ortega in order to move around the balance of power. And I think that's what a strategy should focus on, both in terms of sanctions and in terms of incentives for them. And on the other hand, it is really imperative to think about the other side of the coin. How do you strengthen Nicaraguan civil society? How do you strengthen Nicaraguan demands? Because again, I mean, it's not just a question of how to weak Ortega, but how to strengthen Nicaraguan society. And yes, there will be a moment in which negotiations will be a way to establish a solution. But if you want my personal opinion, I don't see those effective negotiation taking place with Ortega and Murillo. I will imagine a future in which, in one way or another, some successors of Ortega and Murillo will be the one there in order to participate in those negotiations that basically will have to talk about electoral reform and to go to new elections. Is that possible with Ortega and Murillo? Not at all. I don't think so. I only think that they will be forced under pressure, both international and national, in order to move into a new dynamics of change and crisis.
Thank you, Carlos. I think the message is very clear. Negotiations down the road, yes. Today, no. With these guys, no.
Can I answer?
Yes, Bianca, I want to turn to you on this subject, but if I can just add one thing. Carlos Fernando talked about sort of peeling off, you didn't use his word, but I think this is what you meant, influential people, whether in the armed forces or in the business community, if there are any business people left supporting the regime. Two thoughts, Bianca. First of all, how is this accomplished? And secondly, and this is going to be backward looking, but I think it's important to put it out there anyway, the Nicaraguan elite, and particularly the business elite, was remarkably tolerant of what already a few years ago was clearly an attempt at weakening democracy in Nicaragua and doing away with fundamental human rights in Nicaragua. So can we really hope that some of these decision makers, some of these influential people will see the light of day? And if so, how?
Thank you, Andres. I agree with most of what Carlos Fernando said, but you have put forward a very critical question. And I think that on another event where Carlos Fernando and me, we were being interviewed, we discussed the need not only for pressure from the international community, from sanctions and trade agreement sanctions. I continue to push for that. But it is important as well, the response, as you just mentioned, that the elite in Nicaragua, the business community, the wealthiest family, what role are they going to play? They have been, to a certain degree, and I know that I've been hard on, many of them have been complicit with the Ortega Murillo regime. In fact, Daniel Ortega, it's only arrived where he is today to be a dictator for life in Nicaragua with Rosario Murillo, because the wealthiest family, or many of the wealthiest family, and the elite and the business community did deals with him. He introduced neoliberal policies into the country, and he allowed him to dismantle all legal and democratic institutions, keeping in silence. I must bring to you that I was in Nicaragua in 2018 to support the release of a report by Amnesty called Shoot to Kill, and that I spoke to members of the COSAC, spoke to members of the business elite, where I conveyed to them the request from the people to have indefinite and general strikes in the country. And they gave me all the reasons why it will harm the economy, and they weren't ready to do anything. We have seen as well that there's been a deafening silence from many of them. I think that they made a miscalculation, and that now we have about five members of the business community who are in jail. But there are many who are still there. There are many who could play the role. There are many who could put pressure together with the international community, sanctions and the trade agreements that needs to be reconsidered by the US, by the European Union, and as well the role that the Latin American countries need to play in with Nicaragua, because they are very, very important. Let's not ignore them. Let's not think that it's all up to the US, Canada, the UK, the European Union, the countries of the OAS, the countries in Central America need to play a key role if we will ever bring Daniel Ortega to a negotiating table. But what I want to say is, let's not be fooled. Let's not allow Daniel Ortega to mock us one more time. What Carlos Fernando has said is absolutely true. He will use the prisoners as a bargaining chip, just like he did before. Release them and begin to put them one by one in jail. So the moment is not now for negotiation. The moment is for pressure from outside and pressure from inside. Thank you.
Thank you, Bianca. Important point, very, very clearly made. We're going to turn now to questions from our audience, and I'm happy to report that we have a large audience from many countries, judging from the people asking questions. And of course, we will have many more once this event becomes a podcast and it will be available. And, you know, in our experience, thousands of people download the podcasts of our events. So the words and the ideas and the plans we're sharing here are pretty likely to have a broad dissemination in the UK, but also very far beyond the UK. So I'm going to turn to questions, as I said, and I will remind speakers, please, to provide us with pithy and brief answers so that we can get to as many questions as possible. Let me start with William Vigil, who has two questions, actually one question with two halves. One is aimed at James. William says, there are lots of Caribbean Commonwealth members in the OAS, and many of them abstained in the recent vote on Nicaragua. Can, should, will the UK help persuade them to come along and be more active. And to Xavier, along the same lines, the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, CABEI, is nowadays the main source, or one main force of funding for the Ortega regime. Spain is a member of the board of CABEI. What is Spain planning to do to stop this funding? James, maybe you first and then Xavier.
Thanks, Andres. Quickly, the Commonwealth is an association of independent sovereign states, of course, but at the heart of the Commonwealth states' commitment to each other and with each other is the Commonwealth Charter. And at the heart of the Charter is the principle and practice of democracy. To answer the question, yes, we regularly talk about democracy with members of the Commonwealth. Both as sort of bilateral discussions, also in a multilateral fora. At the end of the day, as we know, these governments are all free to take their own positions. We see this in relation to situations around the world. But yes, it's something we'll discuss with members of the Commonwealth, including in the Caribbean. And it's, as I've set out today, these are issues, we're talking about issues in Nicaragua, on which we take a very firm position of principle. Thanks, Andres.
Thanks, James. Xavier.
Thanks, Andres. Well, regarding CABEI, we don't have now information on projects funded nowadays being received by institutions or actors involved in the repression. That's the first point. The second one, the institution has its own statutory structure and its member states, organizations, member states, institutions, decision-taking process in which there are many member states which are involved, and we are only part of the system. But of course, bearing in mind these elements, we do think that there is a room for acting in this area and checking carefully all the projects approved by the bank, and in case there is something that has to be redirected, of course we are ready to talk with our partner countries, because in the end the decision is taken by majority and depending on the capital percentage, and we are not the main holder, so we need to engage with them. And also always taking into account that any decision taken in this area must avoid having a negative impact on the Nicaraguan people at the same time. So it's very difficult to find the balance between the different elements. But that's a point that has to be also taken into consideration.
We have plenty of questions on other subjects. I'm going to turn back to Carlos, Fernando, and Bianca in a second. But while we're on the subject of money and international organizations, there are a couple of questions. They're not directly related to either James or Xavier, but either one of you could address them perhaps. In cases such as this one, and it's never easy, but it has been done, democracies have used their seats on the board of places like the World Bank or the IMF or the Inter-American Development Bank to curtail the flow of lending. Is this something that the EU or the UK might be prepared to do at some point?
Can I answer that? In the Renacer Act, it addresses this issue that they will have, the US and was signed into law by President Biden, they will increase the oversight over the lending issue of institutions such as the World Bank, the IMF and other, and also talked about CABEI. So I think that I hope, and I hope as well, that it's not only going to be from the United States, but from the UK, from the European Union, and for other countries that will play a role to prevent that more money is being lended to the Ortega regime.
Our friends from Spain and the UK, any thoughts on World Bank, IMF, IDB lending before we move on to other subjects? Just... Xavier, James, any thoughts on this?
Well, it's something that has that can also be examined. In fact, it's the same that I said before regarding the CABE. It's an option, but in from our perspective, every measure that is taken in this area has to be carefully analyzed in order to avoid damaging the Nicaraguans.
Thank you. I'm looking at questions here, plenty of good ones. Let me stop and ask this one from Dr. Diana Pritchard. She says that in Nicaragua, the military has not fulfilled its role to uphold the constitutions and has directly and de facto supported the repression. What kinds of sanctions or what kinds of measures could be applied to the military in Nicaragua so as to, I'm going to quote here, weaken their loyalty? Might the freezing of their own overseas assets work? Dr. Pritchard asks, are there pensions invested overseas? I find that maybe that's the case. If that were the case, I'd be surprised. Carlos, you want to take a crack at that? Role of the military and what can be done about it?
Well, the head of the army, General Avilés, is the one who is responsible for this political alignment between the army and Ortega. And he has failed in his constitutional right to disband the other army that Ortega created, that was the paramilitary army. There is no, probably there are other forces within the institutional army that would like to move in a different direction. But as long as Avilés and the other members of the high-ranking commando are there, that will not happen. Now, what Dr. Pritchard is saying is about the whether it will have an impact or not, a sanction against the Instituto de Previsión Social Militar, which is like the business branch of the army and the investment for the pension funds of the officers. Well, yes, that is an option. I understand that is an important option that will have an impact in other sectors of the army that are not co-responsible for this political involvement in which they have been participated. I think the army may have a role in a democratic transition, but again, not with General Avilés and the other high-ranking officers. They must be removed one way or another. And then we will have probably a different situation.
Let me ask a question from a Venezuelan who's listening in, a man called Harold Minarro, and I'm gonna read it. He says, I am from Venezuela and I have direct experience of targeted sanctions applied in the case of my country. And of course, there are many studies that also seem to indicate that instead of forcing the hand of the regime, sanctions often bring worse persecution. And if we're talking about trade agreements or loans, they could also be counterproductive from the point of view of the welfare of the population of Nicaragua. What do you think? Is this collateral damage? Is it a necessary damage? Or is it something that can be sorted out? Anybody who'd like to take a crack at that? Carlos.
Yes, I want to make a comment on that and to go back to the role of the business elite and the private sector. I agree with a friend from Venezuela. I mean, sanctions by itself do not remove a dictatorship. There is the need to strengthen civil society. And in this case, there is one major distinction between Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela, and that is the economy. we Nicaraguan economy is a private economy run by the not only by the business elite, by the private sector as a whole. Now they are in a state of fear, in a state of silence. They are hostages like the rest of Nicaraguan society. But I think that there is the need for incentives for the private sector, not only the Nicaraguan private sector, but the regional private sector to play a role, not as the leaders of change, but probably an important pressure group that could be that could play a role, not in changing Ortega and Murillo's mind, but those people around them. I'm talking about the ministers of finance, of the central bank, the generals of the army. The moment in which they see the private sector saying there's no way out unless there is political change, the economy will never move around. And I think that's also an incentive for the private sector in order to avoid trade sanctions, which I don't support the elimination of CAFTA for Nicaragua. I think it will be a disastrous for the labor sector, and it will have a terrible impact. So the best incentive for the private sector not to lose CAFTA will be to act, but they need some kind of support from different sources. That's the way I see it.
Can I answer?
Yes, of course.
Can I respond to this question? I will give you first an experience that I had in Nicaragua in 1990 to respond to Carlos Fernando. It was during the election with his mother, who won the election, Doña Violeta Barrios de Chamorro. And I was doing a little documentary for, because I had gone back to study filmmaking. And I went to markets and I went to churches and I went to ask people who they were going to vote for. And of course, the cleverest thing that was done during that election was to create the soundbite, the "your vote is secret." So it was very hard for me to get people to tell me the truth of who they were going to vote. They would say, "Doña Bianca, our vote is secret." But they mentioned two things. One was the obligatory military service. And two was the embargo and the economy and the difficulties that they were living and why they were going to vote for Mrs. Chamorro, even though it was very hard for them to admit to that. I come back to this and I would like to say the following. It is a very difficult thing for me as a human rights defender to be here asking for suspending. It is not to permanently suspend Nicaragua, but to suspend from the DR CAFTA and for the European Union to consider about reviewing their trade agreements. You cannot have trade agreements with a dictatorship. It is not within the rules of engagement between this country and Nicaragua. Now, the other thing that is very important, it is that the business community needs to understand, are they for democracy and are they with the people of Nicaragua or are they with Daniel Ortega? Will they bring down the country and will they allow the suspension of Nicaragua from the CAFTA for continuing to support a murderous regime like the Ortega-Murillo regime?
Thank you, Bianca. Thank you very much. James, I see you raising your hand.
Thanks, Andres. I'll just come with a couple of thoughts. First, on the corporate side, one is that foreign companies are very conscious of their reputations, not all of them, of course, but the responsible foreign companies are conscious of their reputations with shareholders and it matters to them. Second, all companies take quite careful account of the rule of law. And any system in which one man can decide what a judge decides on his personal whim discourages investments because companies like to feel that they are operating in a secure legal framework. So I think that the situation in Nicaragua will be having a real effect on companies which are considering doing business with companies in the country. And a reflection on sanctions and the armed forces and also the police, which is not everyone, of course, who joins the armed forces and the police, but many young people who join these organizations do so with a sense of pride and optimism and because they want to serve their countries and their people. And while one, yes, one can look at the sort of actual financial impact of, you know, sanctions, we sanctioned, as I mentioned, two senior officers in the police just today. The fact of being sanctioned does attract real stigma. And it's not the sort of stigma that senior officers like to have, because it will worry them that even if they don't talk about it to their faces, it's what junior officers will be talking about when they meet in private. So I think that, again, going back to the earlier point, collective international sanction does have a real impact, but it's not always easy to put one's finger on precisely what that is. Thanks.
Thank you, James. We are short of time, but there's one last question that that I'd like to pose to the panel, and then maybe give people a minute or, you know, 1 minute for a parting thought. The question is from Dudley Ankerson, who is with Latin Insight Consulting here in London. And it's a long question, so I'm going to summarize it. Question says, how much can the EU, the UK, and even the US achieve as long as two key members of the UN Security Council do not support their efforts? And indeed, in the case of Russia, continue to support the regime. I presume China is the other unnamed country. How do participants believe that given these two countries' attitudes, other democratic nations can actually make progress in bringing Nicaragua back to democracy? Hard question, but if anybody has a thought or two on this, I'd be most welcome. Or let me phrase it differently. Does it make a bit difference that China and Russia are either actively supporting or at least sitting on the fence? Or does it not matter very much?
Russia is actively supporting. Ortega is inviting Russia to be part of the conflict. The Renacer law has made a very clear point on that. Although I would say that Russia's support is mostly political in intelligence aspect, it doesn't have a real structural impact. I don't think there's anything to do with the Security Council because of Russia and China. I would look for other partners like the Vatican. I would hope Pope Francis will have some kind of a word to say in this issue of the political prisoners and the Nicaraguan Catholic Church, which is being persecuted. How can we understand the Vatican silence? Well, people say they have ways of working in their diplomacy. Okay, let's wait for the result, because we haven't seen anything from the Vatican.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask one last question of James. Where's the question here? I seem to have lost it. From Juan Martinez, who's involved with SOES UK. And he points out that, as a result of the repression in the country, there are many more people from Nicaragua seeking asylum in the United Kingdom. And he is wondering, Juan is, what kind of support can be made available for people considering this change and in fact seeking freedom abroad, or in this case, in the United Kingdom? Any thoughts on that, James?
Thanks, Andres. There's not much I can say in answer to the question on this call. We've noted how generous countries around the region have been, particularly in the Venezuelan context. You know, Venezuela, a country which 5 or so million citizens have fled, and the generosity of neighbors. And much smaller case Nicaragua is, but certainly some Nicaraguans have traveled further afield, but many are still in the region. But I won't offer a view now on sort of UK asylum policy. If I could just come back quickly to Doug Dankerson's previous question about Russia and China. It depends, of course, what Russia and China's interests are, but certainly if you look at China, the investor around Latin America today, a very significant investor and important partner for governments and companies around the region. And they too with a strong interest in stability and in the rule of law. And democracy is a friend of both, not an enemy of both stability and the rule of law. Thanks.
Thank you, James. We have exactly 0 minutes, but I would like to give people the chance to have less than a minute or a minute at most to offer a parting thought. Let me begin with you, Xavier, then Carlos, then Bianca, and then my friend Chris.
Thank you. Well, I would finish saying that the thing is that we cannot allow Nicaragua to become an example to follow. So that's why we have to be even more vocal, and we have to contribute to work as aligned as possible. I mean, the international community, all those who have the same views, who share the same views, and at the same time work together, especially with the region and all the democratic, political, economic, and social actors of Nicaragua. We need to work with them.
Thank you. Carlos.
I have two last words. First, remember, this is a middle-round crisis that requires permanent attention and a strategy at the middle run. And number two, this is also a regional crisis. There is migration from Nicaragua to the south and north, and this will aggravate in the next months because Ortega's re-election only came to aggravate this crisis.
Thank you, Carlos Fernando. Bianca.
First, I would like to thank the United States and Great Britain for these new sanctions. I didn't mention it before. I'd like to thank Spain and the government of Spain and the European Union for the support that they have given to Nicaragua and to the 25 countries that declare at the OAS that the elections were illegitimate. But I'd like to, I'd like to say the following, please don't forget us. Don't just be attentive to us at the moment. We need your help. People are being brutally persecuted in Nicaragua. And I'd like to make an appeal to the Secretary General of the United Nations that could play a key role in Nicaragua. There are two people who could play a really important role. One is the Pope, and I hope that he will speak out and that he will play an important role because, as Carlos Fernando mentioned, the members, priests and bishops, have been persecuted in Nicaragua and the Nicaraguan people. So please do not forget us. Do not forget the Nicaraguan people.
Thank you very, very much, Bianca. Chris, your final thoughts?
It's difficult to be optimistic or hopeful, but I do want to say, you know, it's inspiring that there is a rare moment of consensus and even sophistication in the discussions around sanctions and what to do, who should be the players be. And while I agree entirely with Bianca that the world should not move on and focus on other things and let's try to keep the attention on Nicaragua, I will say, I think this level of sophistication in discussing what to do and how to push it forward is something that I wish I had seen in other countries. And so if there's some reason for hope, it's this coordination, this level of commitment and solidarity and original creative thinking on what is to be done. So I appreciate everyone's very thoughtful answers and reflections on this and policy. So thank you all. And thank you, Andres. Always a pleasure to collaborate.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for that note of hope as we come to an end. On behalf of the LSC, and if I may also Chatham House, thank you very much. And I want to end on a personal note. And this goes back to what Bianca said, don't forget us. I myself grew up in Chile during another dictatorship, that of Augusto Pinochet. And people from around the world not only did not forget Chileans living under repression, but they were very active and they helped a great deal. In fact, I met Bianca Jagger, I'm not sure she remembers, but she probably does, back in 1988, when she was an international observer at the plebiscite that eventually removed Pinochet from office. And in fact, I was a young man who was sent to the airport to fetch her and bring her into town. So I have been a witness of her commitment to human rights and democracy for many, many years. And that commitment is stronger by the day. So thank you very much, Bianca. Thank you to everybody who has joined us tonight or today or this afternoon, wherever you are.